Hi everyone, my name is Abby and I'm here with my co-host Perdis, and welcome back to Med Made Real. For those of you newly joining, thank you for tuning into this episode. This is a podcast that highlights the life-changing aspects of medical treatments and procedures while giving people with lived experience a platform to share their stories. On today's episode, we're honored to welcome Dr. Yvonne Yang from Ottawa. Dr. Yang will share her extensive experiences as a pediatric plastic surgeon and her impactful work with Operation Smile. Her academic background includes a Master's of Science in Engineering with a focus on biomaterials from Johns Hopkins University, a Master's in Global Surgery from King's College London, and a medical doctorate from the University of Calgary. She completed her residency in plastic surgery at McMaster University in 2007 and her fellowship in pediatric plastic surgery at the Hospital for Sick Children in 2008. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Yang.
Thanks for having me.
So just to get started, I think one of our main themes of this podcast was to discuss your experiences as a pediatric plastic surgeon, but also how that kind of relates to your work with Operation Smile. So just to start, what is Operation Smile and what inspired you to get involved with this organization?
Operation Smile is a kind of nonprofit organization based in the US, but there is a Canadian office as well that's focused primarily on access to surgery for cleft lip and palate around the world, mostly in countries where historically it has not been accessible. And so I've been involved with them probably when I shortly after I started practice, kind of being involved in some different missions and in different ways. I think earlier on, I was involved in a few more trips and then in some educational programs. I haven't been as involved lately in terms of the regular missions, but I'm supposed to be going with them and sort of a mentorship mission in the next little while.
Okay. And can you like describe like a typical mission with Operation Smile and like what that looks like?
As the organization has evolved, what a typical mission has changed. So there are definitely some missions that are the way people traditionally think of them, and there's a group of people who arrive. We bring a whole operative team in terms of surgeons, but also anesthetists, perioperative nurses, child life, dentists. You bring a large group and you see a lot of patients and do a lot of surgeries and provide a lot of care. But they also do a lot of kind of smaller missions. I have done some trips with them and they've done some things around burns as well. But I've done small trips where there's maybe four or five of us and really working with local surgical groups in terms of training around surgery, nursing, and anesthesia and all the different aspects. And then there are also larger teaching missions where you go and there's a large group, but a lot of local surgeons join you as well. For example, I did a mission in Haiti a bunch of years ago, and through that I met there was a kind of a general surgery, a young general surgery resident at the time who worked with us and was interested and learning about cleft care and surgery. And then he finished his general surgery residency. And then eventually actually was my global surgery fellow here a few years ago. And just kind of a chance to meet and to find people interested. And he's interested in sort of reconstructive surgery. And so he works as a general surgeon, but does a lot of reconstructive and burn stuff now for MSF. So a lot of connections that you can make through these trips.
That's awesome. It's nice to hear that's like a kind of collaborative approach between different medical fields, but also like between different like healthcare teams as well, and opportunity to meet people and learn from each other as well. I was wondering, what are some of like the main challenges and rewards that you've noticed with Operation Smile and maybe just global surgery as a whole?
Oh, well, I would say if you look at more traditional missions in places where there is not access to local surgical care, so I think there are lots of different ones where you go where there are surgeons available, but just not enough. And so you can kind of go and help with the volume, but sometimes where there are very few surgeons available and there's a huge backlog of patients. I think one of the most challenging things is when you arrive, you have an idea of how many patients are registered to be screened for surgery, and you know that there's no way you can operate on all the patients who have arrived. So you arrive kind of knowing that there are people who are going to be turned away who would benefit from surgery. And I think that's probably the most difficult thing to do when you could help them, but you don't have the means to do so on this trip. And you're not entirely certain when they might have access in the future.
And I
And I
think
think that in global surgery in general, that can sometimes be a challenge in terms of resource limitations. And when you know that something can be done and you cannot do it there because of various reasons, either you don't have the equipment, You don't have the monitoring. You don't think that it's safe to proceed. And those are challenging when you know that there are things that can be done and that could have a significant change in their quality of life.
And like just to kind of understand a little bit about how you divide your time, I guess, because currently you're working at a tertiary center in Ottawa, and like how do you split up your time essentially with like going and doing these missions versus like staying in Ottawa and also being a plastic surgeon here? I'm sure that's like very, I'm assuming it's very kind of difficult to coordinate, but like it seems like you're doing it so well. So I'm just trying to understand how that works.
Think one thing is having really supportive colleagues. So we have an agreement in terms of how much time I'm away and how I put in my hours here. So in terms of I have to do all the same amount of call or clinics, but my colleagues accommodate kind of that on and off. So when I'm here, I work a bit more and they work a little less. And when I'm away, they work and kind of pick up my clinical load when I'm away. So definitely, I think it's really important to have colleagues who are willing to accommodate those changes. So we have, even if I work the same amount, I do it in a little bit more spurts, and so they have to accommodate that. And I think having a team where I trust that they're going to take care of my patients when I'm away, because if I operate and I have a complication and I'm not here, someone that I know will take care of my patients when I'm not here.
Okay, and just for my and just to clarify, so when you do travel on these surgical missions, you essentially just do cleft lip, cleft palate, or is it just cleft lip, or what kind of procedures do you usually?
Depends. With Operation Smile, they're primarily focused on cleft lip and palate, although I have done a few other things related to burns with them, but I would say that would be a small percentage of what Operation Smile does. I also work with other groups, or I do some trips that are not with groups at all, just specifically kind of teaching missions that I might cover other areas. Like I'd say burns is another large area, because kind of that burden of disease for burns is very high in low and middle income countries because of open fire cooking, less kind of fire prevention. So that's a big problem. But with Operation Smile, it is more focused on cleft lip and palate.
Okay.
Oh,
Sorry,
go
sorry.
for it. Sorry.
Sorry, just out of my curiosity, when you when working with like cleft lip, cleft palate patients, like do you also have to consider like if these like injuries associated with it too? So like I'm just speaking from my personal experience having done a master's in global health where we looked at like acid case victims and burn victims where like they're also there's a lot of deformities or like maybe some injuries to like around the lip and palate area, just around the typical face area. Does Operation Smile also include treating those burns? I think you just briefly mentioned burns, but is that part of your care as well?
I'm going to say traditionally no. So and I think they have missions. When I've done burns with them, they've had specific burn missions and not cleft missions. But when they're doing cleft missions, it's specifically cleft. And the patients are usually screened. They usually have local teams and collaborators who screen the patients before we get there so that they know that they are reasonably appropriate patients.
It's always you touched a little bit on how like open fire cooking and things like that are something that's common in different areas. So it's always interesting to kind of hear about what pathologies are more common in different countries or different areas, just based off of various cultures and I guess norms and things like that. I was wondering, in specific with your work with cleft lip and cleft palate repair, typically compared to typically developing young children, how do these pathologies like cleft lip and cleft palate affect children from more of like a psychosocial and a functional standpoint?
So I think the cleft lip and palate in a way are different because of that. So cleft lip, I think, is much more visible. And so I think kids, if they don't have it repaired or repaired poorly where it's very visible, that can be challenging in terms of social aspects or teasing or things like that. But in a way, the palate is more important in terms of function, because we repair the palate so that you can have speech. And if you don't have speech that people can understand, that is very debilitating in terms of being able to have a job, being able to communicate. And so that's really a functional component of it.
Okay, and I guess just like briefly, if you could kind of go over what kind of treatment is involved for these pathologies, like how you go about repairing them, maybe just a brief brief overview. I know you have probably done lots of
Yeah,
work in training like years, but
not trying to describe the operation, but I would say that there's different protocols for doing cleft lip and palate repairs in terms of different ways to do it or different ages to do it. In Canada, we do the cleft lip repairs around 3 months of age, but I would say abroad, they tend to, on average, especially on an ophthalmology mission, they tend to do them a little bit older. And there's no functional consequences of doing the cleft lip older, 6 months, 12 months of age. The palate repair, we like to do them under a year of age in Canada, but I would say under two, for sure, because like I said, the palate repair is functional in terms of speech. And so you want to do the palate and have it repaired before they start talking a lot, because if your palate isn't repaired, you can have a lot of errors in your speech that can be more difficult to correct later on once you've kind of built these habits. So usually we do the lip repair, the palate repair, and then in the future, there are some other surgeries, mostly related to dental or orthodontics, and then therapy, especially around speech.
Right. I guess because of like the close relation with speech, and I know this can differ based on area, but do you ever work with ENT physicians as well for these kinds of procedures? And does that change when you're doing like global surgery versus here in Ottawa?
Yeah, so in Canada, when we're in Ottawa, the ENT surgeons are part of our cleft team. A lot of kids with cleft palates need meningotomy tubes, so they always see them, and majority do get meningotomy tubes. Globally, there are some ENT surgeons who do cleft lip and palate surgery, and so that's something that's regional in terms of the country, and they certainly know the anatomy there. So that would be some do the cleft surgery itself. In terms of meningotomy tubes and hearing tests, we don't tend to do that as much abroad. I think partly to do with kind of if they get tubes and the follow-up. There have been some studies that I looked at, and I don't know a lot on the literature on this, but in the long term, it doesn't affect your hearing, but it probably does affect your hearing earlier on in terms of if you don't get the tubes and does that affect speech development or ear infection rates or things like that. I think there are some differences in terms of rates of ear infections. A little bit is temperate. You know, here in North America, kids get sick a lot more in the winter. So in more temperate climates, you know, that kind of season and how often you get ear infections is a little bit different. And I don't know that there's a lot of data on that.
And you briefly.
But I would say ENT surgeons are less commonly there in terms of managing ear findings. And if they are, they're more commonly, they happen to be cleft surgeons as well.
Oh, okay.
And I'm sorry, you briefly mentioned that, you know, follow-up with a lot of the patients that you work up with or work with, but how does that follow-up look like? Like, just I'm just trying to understand in terms of logistically, if you're spending, let's say, I'm assuming 6 to 12 weeks, I think that's the last, from what you mentioned, doing these missions, and then you come back, and then when you return back to these missions, do you ever follow up with the same patients that you've worked on, or do you hear about these patients from the countries that you've visited and worked with? I'm just trying to see how that follow-up is like, and if there are any like concerns.
Very different depending on the project. So I'm not usually away for that long. Most of these missions, if we're going to talk about missions, are usually like 1 to 2 weeks.
Okay.
But it depends on the group. So for example, when you do operations mom missions, they often have local collaborators. So they have local physicians or surgeons on the ground, depending on where they are, who will sometimes do the follow-ups. And they often do the screening of the patients ahead of time. There are some missions, especially the larger ones, where the team will go, they'll operate, but one or two members will stick around and do the follow-up appointments for the next 1 or 2 weeks just to see and make sure everyone is healed or if they have any complications and they need to book them in for next time. Most of the complications that you get with cleft lip and palate surgery either need to be managed right away, in which case we're still there. So we tend to operate and not leave that day. And then the other complications, for example, if you get an infection or things like that, you don't usually operate on them. They can be treated medically. And then if they need surgery again, you want to wait a period of time before you go ahead anyways. So they would kind of be brought back for the next mission to be seen again. In other organizations, for example, when you work with a local team or I've done missions with local groups, the local groups are on the ground all the time and they do the follow-ups longer term.
Right. And I think I remember asking this question when we had this little get together during CSPS when we were talking about Operation Smile. But I think a question that did come up that was quite interesting to me was when you're working with these local healthcare providers, do you find that based on the country that you're visiting, there's a little bit of like tension with respect to the treatment that you can offer versus what the government in at the country that you visit offers them? Like, is there any like, I don't know how to put this, but more so, yeah, are there any sort of external kind of politics involved with the level of treatment that the Operation Smile is providing versus what can be offered there? And is there like a sort of like tension between them?
Tension, but I would say that there's, in the end, you know, the government decides what they want to pay for. And in a lot of countries, there is no public health care. And I think it's a luxury in Canada that we often take for granted, where there is no public health care, so the government doesn't pay for anything, right? And it's about kind of which patients, even if there are surgeons who are trained and are able to do it, there sometimes aren't enough. Or if there are, they patients can't afford to access care. So they can't afford to pay the rates for the surgery. And I think, to be fair to the surgeons, they can't always do it for free because they need to put a roof over their heads and feed their families. And so it's, I think there are a lot of challenges when there isn't a sufficiently funded public healthcare system. So it's not about what Operation Smile or what international NGOs will pay for. It's just, you know, what is the government paying for in general? I don't think it's usually because they think something is not needed. It's just they have a limited budget and they have to decide what they want to allocate the funds towards.
Right. Okay. No, that makes sense. That makes sense. And I guess another kind of tangent to that is, I know typically Operation Smile works with already current like practicing physicians and surgeons, but is there any way medical students or even just like undergraduate students can like get involved to a certain extent to help out with this organization? Like, I'm only asking this because I'm currently the Operation Smile Ambassador of Ottawa, but like apart from like fundraising, apart from fundraising and helping with Operation Smiles in that sense, like, is there anything else that you can recommend or maybe advise?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, there are non-medical people who come on the missions in terms of, you know, administrative people, because someone has to manage all the charts and the paperwork. But I don't know, to be honest, I don't know how they select for those positions. We don't normally take medical students on the mission. They do sometimes take residents.
Okay.
And Operation Smile does offer some fellowships, specifically where they fund residents to attend, specifically missions where they don't think another learner from a high income country is going to take away from learning from a local experience, a local trainee. But there are some countries where there's a good, robust training program, but there's just a lot of patients and they just kind of need people to come and do cases. And so those are the missions where sometimes they will take international fellows.
Okay, that makes sense.
I was wondering, because we talked a little bit about like limited resources sometimes with global surgery. With Operation Smile, is there ever a time where you also maybe like help provide some like tools or instruments or things like that? Or is it mostly just bringing like physicians and surgeons to these areas?
Yeah, I think that they do, because I think often they bring supplies, and if you don't finish using them, they're donated to the local hospital. And then some of it is, you know, consumable stuff. Sometimes it's equipment, and it really depends on that partnership and depending on the location, how much they support, because sometimes they want to support the local surgeons who might join us on a mission to continue this work when they're not there. So part of the benefit for them of joining for the week is that they can, you know, get some skills, build some connections, but also sometimes they can get some supplies so that they can continue to do the surgery after we're gone.
Okay. And another question I had was, in your experience working with local surgeons, or maybe like surgeons across the globe, do you find that like you've learned a lot about different maybe approaches to surgery from their experience that maybe you've kind of used in your practice here?
Absolutely. And I think that surgeons specifically on an OPSWELL mission, I've done a mission with, you know, there was myself, a surgeon from the US, one from Sweden, a couple from South Africa. And we do things very differently. The Scandinavians do their clefts very differently. We do the South Africans do a totally different technique for lip repair, and I don't know that necessarily changed what I do all the time. But knowing these little things, when you have exceptional cases, you'd be like, oh, but I could maybe do it this way because there was this trick I learned from them. So I've learned so much from my colleagues from around the world, and I think that's certainly one benefit of these kind of missions from different countries. Also, my colleague, for example, I have a colleague in Congo who's, worked with surgeons from so many different places that he's picked up on all these tips. Because in a way, we inbreed a little bit here. If you train in Canada, you train people who work in Canada, we tend to all do things more uniformly across the country than if you compare like Canadian ways to do it and even the American ways to do it. And when you start going to other countries, you start realizing there's so many different ways to do it, and things that we treat as dogma here are not. And you can do it very differently and still have a good outcome. And so knowing those things, I think, are really important to make you a better surgeon, especially for cases that are different.
Right. Wow. Thank you, Dr. Yang. I think that's such a valuable thing when you're learning from different surgeons across the world, because like I feel like when we try and standardize a typical way of doing things in Canada, but like, when you learn from different surgeons, you can still, it's nice that you can like bring those experiences back and like, tailor it to who you're seeing here, especially because we're such a multicultural society. So you never know how it's gonna help with how those experiences are really gonna help. I guess, we're getting to the end of our podcast, but I had one more question I would like to ask you. Do you have can you share like a particularly memorable case or a patient story from your time with Operation Smile that has really like stood out to you, or like if someone were to ask you what's like the one thing that or one case that really like sticks out, and if you'd like to share that.
That stick out specifically, I would say a couple things. With Op Smile, I would say less specific for patient cases, partly because some of the Op Smile missions, you're just doing so many cases that you, in a way, it becomes a blur, because you're in some of the missions I'm doing, we're trying to do, 6, 8 cases a day per surgeon, and we've run, 5, 6, 7 table lists. So there are, like 30, 40 kids having an operation per day. So it's very high volume, and it is a little hard to keep track. I would say my learning experiences and kind of the surgeons I've met on these missions are kind of really important to me, kind of all the things that I've learned and those kind of friendships, kind of like that fellow that I met. Like I mentioned, he was a resident at the time and we kept in touch and became a surgeon and, was interested in expanding his global surgery skills and came here. So kind of those, and I'm still in touch with some other surgeons and colleagues that I've met on trips, and they're great resources as well. Sometimes I have an interesting case and you can, chat about it. So I think those are kind of the experiences I really remember from working on these kind of larger missions. On the smaller missions I've worked with, I work in Uganda regularly on doing mostly burn contractors. And there, because I go back to the same place and I work with a local team, I've had patients that I've seen repeatedly. And I think those sort of become my patients, even though they're on the other side of the world and I only go once a year. I see them and follow up once a year and have managed to, operate on them a number of times, because a lot of burn contractures require multiple surgeries. And there was one guy that I met who kind of didn't have access to care for many months and had this wound and contracture, and we operated on him, and he came back the next year, and we were able to release his contractures. And then he came back for a few years, and then he kind of really didn't need surgery anymore. He had full movement, but he would come back and he spoke English, which was not true of a lot of the local population. And almost they kind of joked that he was like the manager. And because when we were running this camp, he would help organize all the other patients and help to translate. And I think he was very appreciative of the surgery he was able to get for free and access. And so he would come and essentially almost like volunteer. He'd have his surgery some point in the week, but he would be kind of volunteering and organizing everyone else in the meantime. And I think those are kind of memorable experiences in terms of, the patients having a huge difference in terms of their function. And I think being able to share that, and I think they were understanding of like what opportunities it gave to them and them trying to give back and kind of helping out the other patients.
Thank you.
Amazing to hear. Thank you so much for sharing your experience with that. Is there anything else that you wanted to chat about that we may have not gotten to so far in the podcast?
Say, I think one question I often get from people in terms of, from trainees, from medical students or residents, or even surgeons about interested in getting involved, and how to get involved. And I think that, you just you from the beginning, you can get involved in lots of different ways. As a student, you can do electives, and then same as a resident, you can do electives. And then when you finish your training, kind of going and becoming involved in little things. And I think when you go as a student, you're not going to expect to be helpful, but I think it's good to see, just to experience and figure out if it's something that is right for you and it's not right for everyone. We did a study where we interviewed lots of surgeons involved in global surgery, and part of the recommendation is to kind of get involved early and just make it part of your practice. I think people are like, how do you manage to squeeze this time out? I think that I've always done it from the time I started my practice, so it's normal and it's not squeezing it out because it's always been there. It's just like, everyone always expects to take a few weeks vacation. So this has always been part of my schedule and I really don't know it any different.
Totally.
So encourage people to start early.
And like that reminded me of a question that I had. So I was wondering, what is the best way to kind of look at the work that you do abroad? Maybe not you specifically, but just in general, like global health, global surgery. How do we approach it in like an equitable and like respectful way? I don't know if respectful is like the best word to use, but how's the best way to approach this?
I think that the key is about having the right partnerships, and it's always about a partnership and what do your partners on the ground there want from you. There are some places where I go work and they're like, "Oh, we want you to come and teach this course." And there's some places where like we just want you to come and operate because, we could do this, but there's just too many cases. And so to say that just going to operate is not useful or not capacity building, I disagree with that. I think it's about letting your partners who are working there every day tell you what they need and you trying to provide as much support as you can of what they want, as opposed to you thinking, "Oh, I think this is helpful. Let me do this for you."
Okay, that's really important, I think, to touch on, and I'm glad that you brought that up. So it's more so kind of like listening and getting a sense of what your partners need, and then just trying to kind of help in whatever way they feel it
So sometimes they need things that I can't do, like that is not in my skill
is.
set. But sometimes it's like, okay, well, like I said, sometimes they just want me to come in and work and almost do a locum for a couple weeks so they can have a break. I'm happy to do that. Some are like, we just want you to come teach a course. We'll just come teach a course. So it's about letting them decide what they need, because they know what they need more than you do. And I think that's really what makes it equitable, is having them drive it and not you trying to drive it from far away.
Totally. Okay, I think that's all the questions that we have. Thank you so much, Dr. Ying, for taking the time to discuss Operation Smile, shed light on cleft palate and cleft lip repair, as well as like the impact of global health and surgery. It's always really interesting to hear different people's perspectives and the work that they do, but especially cool to see how surgeons and healthcare professionals kind of come together across the globe to learn from each other and also to perform these operations. And so that wraps up today's episode. Be sure to join us next time on MedMade Real.